The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
And welcome to The Doctor Is In with me, Dr. Dinothra Archer Cartwright, family medicine specialist and consultant. And we're here to talk about all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society. Thank you for joining us this Tuesday evening for another exciting show. And we look forward to just an interesting show tonight. Of course, brought to you by Medical Concierge Services for all your medical needs. Of course, we do family medicine care, home care, concierge medicine, and so much more. Check out our website, mcsfamilymedicine.com, and you can reach us on Facebook and Instagram. Our numbers are 326-1521, and you can also get us on WhatsApp at 429-4880. We have a really special guest with us tonight. Just as we promised last week, we have Dr. Peter McCullough. He's here in the Bahamas with us, visiting with us, and doing a series of media and PR, as well as a special presentation on Thursday night this week at the Church of God. And that's going to be at 7 p.m. And that is something that you do not want to miss. He's going to do a really lively presentation on all things COVID. And we're going to have a time to do a little question and answer as well. But he's here with me tonight, and we're just going to talk. We're going to talk about what's going on, what's new in the U.S., things that we should be aware of, and generally about the whole COVID pandemic. So Dr. Peter McCullough, he's a cardiologist. He's an internist. He's an epidemiologist. He's world-renowned. He's published. He's one of the most published doctors in his field. And he's been at the forefront of COVID from the very beginning, from publishing one of the first guidelines for early treatment to being someone who presented at the Senate and the Congress for the United States. And he's been instrumental in shaping the direction of what's happening in COVID and the response, especially most recently. So Dr. Peter McCullough, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes. And so just first, like, how do you feel just being in the Bahamas?
It feels great. It's restorative. You know, I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas. I spend about half my time, like you, taking care of patients, both in the office, but also remotely by phone. And the rest of the time, I am an author. I am a clinical scholar and investigator. I've been laser focused on COVID-19. In the last 2 years, like you, I have also developed a media presence. I am frequently on national TV in the United States across many stations. I'm a frequent contributor on Fox News. For the first year of the pandemic, I was a regular contributor to The Hill, which is a politically oriented publication in Washington. And now in the second year of the pandemic, I've started my own podcast, America Out Loud Talk Radio, The McCullough Report. And Bahamians clearly can access it because it's on the internet. And you're my special guest for the next show coming up next weekend. So yes, all of the Bahamas can celebrate Dr. Archer Cartwright on The McCullough Report.
Okay, awesome. So everyone is going to have to tune in. I'm going to be on The McCullough Report with Dr. Peter McCullough. So that is awesome. We get to have a little bit of what's happening in the Bahamas on an international stage. So I hope you guys all listen in. So since you've been here, Dr. McCullough, you've gotten a sense of the Bahamas and where we are in terms of COVID. Is there any comparisons to what's happening in the U.S. currently?
Remember, the U.S. is quite varied. So there are places in the U.S. that one can't even enter a building without a vaccine card, some parts of New York City. When I was in Washington for the historic Defeat the Mandates rally on January 23rd and then the U.S. Senate testimony January 24th in the District of Columbia. We couldn't even go in a Starbucks and get a coffee without a vaccine card. But yet if we went over to Virginia, just 5 miles away, we didn't have to wear a mask or anything. We walked in and we ordered anything we wanted. So it's varied in the United States. It's the same virus. It's largely the same epidemiology from state to state, but the responses are different, I think, driven out of relative differences in fear, politics, and other sociological factors.
Yeah, definitely. We've had some ups and downs here. We've been through really extreme lockdowns, and now we're a lot more open than we were before, and we've been lessening our restrictions as we go along. What made you get into it? And we talked about this a little bit the last time we did a Zoom kind of presentation. What made you want to jump in from the very beginning? I know you're a cardiologist and an internist, and you do have an experience with epidemiology as well. But what made you say, hey, I need to get into this? Because you were one of the first doctors to kind of get out there.
Right. I was on task force calls for the health system. And while we were making preparations with masks and personal protective equipment, and how to handle things as an inpatient, I saw the big unmet need was treating patients as an outpatient in order to prevent hospitalization and death. And, you know, I treat pneumococcal pneumonia and atypical pneumonias. I handle respiratory illnesses. I handle asthma and emphysema all the time. And I figured, you know, listen, this is in my wheelhouse. I've been studying the interface between heart and kidney disease. And now, looking back, you know, I have 2 years of dedicated effort on COVID or more. I have 56 publications on the pandemic, including the two seminal early treatment papers. And in many ways, both you and I have done infectious disease fellowships in the last 2 years. We have as much expertise as any infectious disease doctor.
Yes, because, you know, this has come up before, this question of who is a specialist in COVID. And I tell everybody that any doctor who's been, like, practicing and really putting the effort in, doing this, looking at the studies, treating patients, we're all now kind of experts in this. There is no particular expert out there, but we have lived through something that has kind of never happened before in this way. And so it's given us an experience, an unbelievable experience.
And having said that, I think the experts on COVID are divided into two major groups. The doctors managing inpatients, and in the U.S., those doctors are almost exclusively subscribed to hospital care, and they don't manage any outpatients. And then there are the outpatient doctors, the ambulatory doctors, managing patients by phone or in the clinic. I've done both. I've made house calls. And so unlike many other doctors, you know, doctors in the hospital largely don't go in the patient's room because of quarantine and isolation procedures. I've actually gone in people's houses and listened to their lungs. And I can tell you as a doctor, the lung exam of somebody with pulmonary COVID is a distinct exam. There's almost nothing like it. And it is impressive how sick patients get from a respiratory perspective.
So I know we talked about a lot of things that we believe in the beginning was due to fear. What kind of made you not be fearful? Because you're saying you did a lot of home care. You're like me. You actually went into homes. You did a lot of that kind of stuff. What made you feel like, hey, I can do this. I can go out there and I can treat these patients and just not be as fearful as we've seen in our community around the world, even with this kind of novel virus?
I was really, really strengthened by the resolve of the nurses at my health center. So I launched a study with my division chief, who was my boss at the time, using hydroxychloroquine once a week to protect our healthcare workers against COVID-19. We recruited hundreds and hundreds of nurses in the front line. They were in the ER or they're in the ICU. And the nurses ended up doing the testing. My research nurses ended up doing the testing. And I watched how they were unafraid. And I started to realize, wait a minute, if the nurses are unafraid and they're having this much contact, you know, I need to do my part. Now, I never opened up my office to direct COVID care, and, you know, neither did you, but we're doctors in the United States. George Farid and Brian Tyson in South Central California did it. Didier Rialt in France did it. I helped the Sri Lankans in their Delta outbreak, and they clearly managed patients face-to-face outside. And what we learned over time that actually you could manage patients if you saw them outside. There's almost zero chance of catching COVID when you're dealing with somebody else who's sick and you're outside because the air is flowing and there's dissipation of the virus in the air.
Yeah, so we saw a lot of extremes, and you've been in the Bahamas. You can see how some of the policies, some of the restrictions don't match up with the science. But here we are, we're going along, we're still kind of doing these things, and I'm sure that you saw that in different places in the United States too. Why do you think we're still not connecting kind of these ideas? Because they're even having events outdoors, there was a lot of work to get to a place where they would even allow people to have outdoor events, even though that we know that you're probably your safest outdoors when in terms of COVID.
You know, it may be in the Bahamas that there wasn't the confidence in the hospital system that other countries had. And so the idea is, listen, if I got COVID, the hospital may not be able to save me. And so that could be a factor, the lack of availability of therapies. I'm not saying it was much better in the United States, but as we sit here today in the United States, we have hydroxychloroquine by prescription. We have ivermectin by prescription. Ivermectin's over the counter in one state. Now in New Hampshire, we have laws in place that demand the pharmacist dispense ivermectin. We have the Pfizer Paxlovid drug, which is very high quality. It's a combination of nalfenpiravir and ritonavir, a chymase like 3 inhibitor and a protease inhibitor. And then we have the Merck drug, molnupiravir. But we also use azithromycin or doxycycline, inhaled budesonide, widely available, has a large impact on reducing the risks of worsening. We use oral prednisone, widely available, oral colchicine, aspirin. Everyone has aspirin. And then in high-risk patients, nursing home patients, those in wheelchairs, disabled, we use subcutaneous lomecoate heparin called enoxaparin or Lovenox, or we use oral anticoagulants. That's called sequence multidrug therapy for COVID-19. We have some upfront things that are remarkably important. One is virucidal nasal washes. So we're now relying on the Omicron variant in using dilute povidone iodine or dilute hydrogen peroxide, squirting it up the nose, sniffing it back, and spitting it out, doing it twice on both sides. That's a good nasal wash. Gargle with the rest, half a teaspoon, shot glass of water. Everyone can remember that. And that works. There are 12 clinical studies showing over a 70% treatment effect in acute treatment. You can do it up to every 4 hours when you're acutely ill. I personally developed the Omicron variant around Christmas time. I did it. I was amazed how effective it is. I'll always have some peroxide or some povidone iodine in the house. In the United States, it costs about $5. You can order on Amazon. The reason being, it works for the common cold, right, and it works for sinusitis. So the last common cold I had, I did it. And instead of having a week or two of nasal stuffiness and congestion, I was over it in 3 days.
Right. So there, what you're saying is there are these simple kind of solutions that can, and it comes down to knowing the pathophysiology and understanding how the virus affects the body. And a lot of it does start in the nasal passages, you know, that's in the airways, and then it goes down. And what we're seeing as severe COVID is really COVID pneumonia. We're seeing COVID actually going into the lungs. And so that initial phase when it's just up there is really the time that we should be looking at treatment. When do you think is the earliest time? When should we be treating these patients? Because I think we really kind of fell down with early treatment. What we were seeing is patients that were coming in very late, people who were already very short of breath and required oxygenation and everything like that. So when should we really be tackling this, and how do we continue to save lives as we see pockets of COVID throughout the world and even here in the Bahamas?
In a paper appearing in the Medical Monitor, Fazio is the first author. I'm in the author block. We showed with a treatment protocol in Italy that does not require ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, interestingly, that the golden window for early treatment to prevent hospitalization and death is the first 3 days. So we need to get going with oral therapy as well as the virucidal nasal washes. I was recently called to Atlanta to meet with some family members of Martin Luther King, a very prominent African-American family in American history. And when I went over the virucidal nasal washes, one of the family members looked at me and said, "Dr. McCullough, are you telling me that the black people in America could have had hydrogen peroxide or povidone iodine and actually done this and reduced the risks of progression of COVID? Because if we zap it in the sinuses, and we either eliminate the viral burden or knock it down, it doesn't develop into COVID pneumonia. So it markedly reduces the PCR positivity. In fact, it turns the PCR negative in a couple of days. If you don't do anything in the sinuses, people can be PCR positive for weeks. The average person in America doesn't get hospitalized 2 to 4 weeks into the illness. So we have a lot of opportunity to treat at home. And I said, yes, that's the case. In fact, African Americans and Hispanics in the United States have double the mortality of Caucasians. So it was such a good time spent teaching about viricidal nasal washes. And you know, one of our House of Representative members, Representative Mace, has a news article that came out, I want to say a couple months ago, saying, why has the U.S. federal government not educated the public on doing the viricidal, the antimicrobial nasal washes? Now, we mentioned povidone iodine and hydrogen peroxide, but some other things work. So, for instance, a product called Exlear, a product called Cofix, which is also povidone iodine, colloidal silver, even saline washes work if a little Lugol's iodine is put in. So almost anything to wash the sinuses can make an impact.
So I think that's a good first kind of starter thing for people to do if they initially have it and just kind of flush those sinuses. You know, we had a lot of information earlier on about COVID being related to risk factors, but then we went with a very broad approach and a lot of countries with a vaccine-only approach. With all of the information that was coming out, what do you think happened that led us to where we are, where it was very narrow a focus, I guess, on how do we treat and deal with COVID-19?
We missed an opportunity to follow what's called the Great Barrington Declaration. I think everybody in Bahamas should know this happened. In 2020, the big historical landmarks were, I had published the very first early treatment paper in the American Journal of Medicine in August of 2020, and that became the most widely cited downloaded paper in outpatient COVID-19. And then right after it, Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, Martin Kolda from Harvard, and Sunitra Gupta from Oxford published the Great Barrington Declaration, of which thousands of doctors signed. And the Great Barrington Declaration said, listen, we're watching this for 6 months. The illness is amenable to risk stratification, meaning it doesn't affect everybody the same. And what Great Barrington said is just protect the seniors, protect our older people, the high-risk people. Don't lock down young people. Only the sick people need to quarantine, and the only people who really need the protection, early treatment, all the other measures are the seniors. And the Great Barrington implied that if we had a safe and effective vaccine, it should only be used to protect our seniors. And so we understood that the virus can be fatal in someone over age 65, and the older we get, the more likely it's going to be fatal. However, in a child, the virus is indistinguishable from a common cold. So we would never need to treat a child unless they had severe symptoms. Certainly wouldn't need to give a child a vaccine, but we would want to do that for seniors, just like we do for the pneumococcal vaccine, just like we do for so many other conditions.
However, with those vaccines, we didn't see the type of mandatory or the severe push that we did with this particular product. And I think that's what was alarming, if you know, with the Optimist group that we're working with, you know, why that group really kind of came together, because we were watching the rest of the world go through this thing where, you know, it was really being pushed and was being made mandatory in a sense. And we saw that in a low-key manner here in the Bahamas, where it was put into some of the laws that required vaccination. We saw employers trying to put it out there, not as severe as some of the other countries, but it was there. I've never seen anything like that before, and that really kind of made me wake up to what is really going on, because like you, I did look at it as a risk stratification approach. I thought if we get a really good vaccine, it's going to be the persons who are really vulnerable, which would be our older populations. At the time, the data was saying that most of the people that were dying were over the age of 70. So why did we then take a broad stroke? We seem to have just leaped over all of this preventative stuff and moved straight along to what at the time was an experimental medication.
Well, let's just stay on risk stratification for a second. The rollout of the vaccines in the United States actually originally went to first-line workers. First-line workers, typically younger workers, and they were asked to take the vaccine because they were confronting COVID, although we never had any U.S. hospital outbreaks. We had a large number of people who got sick with COVID-19 at certain points of time who worked at hospitals. For instance, Mayo Clinic had an outbreak, as I recall, of about 900 workers. But 85% of the spread occurs at home among family members. It's, the patients weren't giving it to the doctors or vice versa. The workers theoretically could have spread it to one another. There was a paper by Chow and colleagues from a unit of Oxford in Ho Chi Minh City where there was an outbreak at a hospital. They actually locked the workers down in dormitory facilities in the hospital, and then they characterized how the workers spread the virus to one another. However, the kicker was they were all fully vaccinated with the AstraZeneca virus. And so the Chow paper made it clear that the fully vaccinated give COVID to one another in carefully controlled circumstances. And, you know, our U.S. CDC director came out pretty early in 2021 and said, listen, the vaccines do not stop somebody from giving COVID to another person. They don't stop transmission. We knew papers, that paper from Chow, one from Acharian, Rimarisma, and now Accorsi, show that the vaccine does not impact the virus in the nasal passages. The viral load in the nasal passage is the same in someone who's been unvaccinated or vaccinated when they get sick with COVID-19. And so the failure of the vaccines to sterilize the nasal passages means they don't reduce someone's contagiousness. So to ask whether or not someone's taken a vaccine is irrelevant. What's far more important is to ask, are they sick? Mm. Now, if someone is sick, whether they've taken a vaccine or not, if they're coughing or have a fever, they need to stay at home. If they develop symptoms at work or school, they need to excuse themselves and go home. We need flexible employer policies and flexible student excuse policies in order to let people get out of these environments so they don't spread the virus.
Yeah, you made some very important points there. And we talked about this before, about this idea of how does someone who does not have COVID, how would they spread COVID, right? So we have this assumption that everyone has COVID until proven otherwise. Instead of, you know, people who are symptomatic, let's screen them and see how it's going, which we do with other diseases. When we do screening tests, we do that in a population that we think is at risk. We're still seeing that, though. What do you think it'll take for that to go away? It's almost like there's some cognitive dissonance where the information is coming out, but we're lagging. We're lagging with all of this stuff.
The problem came in the medical literature. There were papers published, and you know, one of the leading centers in the United States was University of Washington. That's where I trained as a resident, University of Washington in Seattle, and it was called the Murray Model. The Murray Model assumed that 30 to 50% of all the spread occurred in fully asymptomatic individuals. So somebody would have no symptoms and they could just shoot the virus like a rocket over to someone else. And that modeling, the false assumption of asymptomatic spread, remember, no disease in the history of mankind is spread asymptomatically, meaning that you and I shoot the virus at each other across the room. It's never happened without symptoms. So that false assumption got baked into the literature. Two key papers in the fall of 2020, one by Chow and colleagues, Cao and colleagues, CAO from China, studied 10 million Chinese and proved that asymptomatic spread was not happening. Even if someone had the virus in their nose and they were asymptomatic, they were forming immunity to it. They couldn't spread it. And then another paper by Madewell showing the same thing. So it became clear that asymptomatic spread was not happening. That's very important. That means no asymptomatic testing. And do you know the World Health Organization in June of 2021 said no asymptomatic testing, no testing for screening purposes. That means no testing before sports, travel, no testing in school or employment. The World Health Organization said that. I noticed this because traveling to the Bahamas, I had to get a test. So the Bahamian health authorities are not following the World Health Organization recommendations not to do testing.
Yeah, in fact, we seem to have ramped up testing in a lot of manners. And, you know, they're still very protesting for a lot of things. And a lot of this, too, because we still have this distinction between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. As you say, it's some sense of, I don't know, because the literature does not reinforce those ideas. And so I think it's overcoming those things, which is going to help us get to where we need to be as a country. I think we need to start promoting the Bahamas as the safest place in the world.
It looks amazingly safe. I mean, I'm so happy to see people without masks on around the resort. Now, I'm staying in the reef. It's part of Atlantis. It's beautiful. There's people from countries all over. And no one's wearing masks. People are enjoying the beach. They're enjoying the pool. Remember, the virus is not spread outside. Very important papers from Singapore prove that. And you told me early on they shut down the beaches.
Yes, we had a point where the beaches were shut down. And we were so shocked because as I was telling people, get out in the sun, exercise, get some vitamin D, the beaches were closed, the parks were closed. And so we went through a really, really, really kind of dark time here in such a sunny place.
Well, you know, we had that in the United States. I'll never forget. I watched a lot of CNN. And Sanjay Gupta, the medical correspondent for CNN, was remarking. They showed a man jogging on the Embarcadero in San Francisco and saying, what a terrible man that is. He's not wearing a mask and he's outside jogging. Well, it turns out going outside and jogging is the best thing that we can do. In a paper by Steenkamp and colleagues recently published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, those individuals who are the fittest and were exercising the most have the least chances of COVID and the markedly diminished chances of ever being hospitalized or dying with COVID because they're so fit. So people who are fit and keep themselves lean, they're in great shape. Conversely, obese individuals, those in very poor health, the type of individual who gets short of breath walking up some stairs. You know the types of patients who have sleep apnea and they lay back and it's difficult for them to breathe just sleeping? They're going to get in trouble with COVID.
Right. And so I think a big part of our approach for a country that does deal with a lot of obesity and overweightness was to really take a health directive approach, a primary care approach, and use that as an opportunity to really enforce in Bahamians how we have to make changes. Is that a call, producer?
Yes.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Holiday, this is talking away so long with you, Doc, and Dr. Archer, and your guest.
Speak up, caller. We can't hear you.
Okay.
Yep.
I said, holiday, this is universe, and to you, Dr. Archer, and your guest.
Yes, we can hear you.
We need justice, law, and order in this country. We call the Bahamas. But what I want to ask your guest, right? He spoke of going 5 miles to other country, other city, something of that sort, right? Without wearing mask. Okay. My first question is, how many people in that city in which you talked about walking, going 5 miles without to that place without going wearing mask? How many people had COVID and how many people died from COVID? My other question is here. Knowing that the COVID could reach a person from a distance, why is it that part of your organization has desired people not to be tested? I would hang up and listen.
You got confused about some of the things that were said because we actually said quite the opposite, that COVID doesn't really travel a distance unless you're symptomatic. So I don't know if you understood what he was saying.
Just to clarify, COVID does not spread among asymptomatic people. So if they wear a mask or don't wear a mask, it doesn't matter because they're asymptomatic.
Right.
They don't have the virus, right? There's 12 randomized trials of masks in respiratory illnesses, 2 in COVID, that basically show general masking doesn't work, in part because 18% of the air goes around the mask. The masks don't fit around the face. That's the first point. And the virus is everywhere in the air. The second point is the masks filter out about 3 microns droplet size. The virus is about 1 micron. So the virus moves in and out of the mask. Now, I think masks have a role. I wear a mask as a doctor in the hospital. When we have patients sick in the hospital, we put a mask on them. When we go down to x-ray, we have not had hospital outbreaks. So I think sick people wearing masks in the hospital when we're using x-rays, I think sick people who are getting sick and are at home and they need to wear a mask when a worker comes in the house, what have you, fine. But general masking doesn't work because A, the air goes around the mask. B, the mask doesn't stay on the face completely. People are taking the masks off to eat and what have you. And on top of that, the virus moves in and out through the masks. And so there's been far too big an emphasis on masks and not enough emphasis on the nasal washes, because when the virus comes in the nose, at the end of the day, someone needs to wash out their sinuses. That's far more important than wearing a mask.
I think his other question had to do like where you were walking around, but he was actually talking about Atlantis. Like he's a guest there, so he took a test, and so he doesn't have to wear a mask. They're all not wearing masks anymore in the hotel unless you're staff. So I'm not too sure where the caller got his other point from about what city or something like that, but I think he misinterpreted what you said.
Yeah, so I'm a guest here. I'm an American guest. I'm staying in Atlantis. They recently let down the mask requirements. Mm-hmm. And so we're not wearing masks around the campus. But sure, if I took a test before I left the United States, that's no guarantee that I'm not going to get sick with COVID. Again, because the test is a useless activity. We can't rely on these tests. The tests in multiple studies have a less than 1% yield to being positive. And when they're positive, the majority are false positives.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So since we had a caller, if we have anyone else who wants to jump in, 323-6232, 325-4316. 325-4259. I don't have the little text phone, so I won't give that number. But, it's really interesting. We're here with Dr. Peter McCullough. We're talking about COVID-19. We're talking about what's happened and what do we look forward to into the future. I think we all kind of understand that we have with young children is another place, because I have young children, about vaccination in young children.
Well, COVID-19 itself was a source of anxiety and worry in the first year of the pandemic. But in the second year of the pandemic, what grew over time was worry about the vaccines. The vaccines were offered in the United States free, and it was purely voluntary in December of 2020, January of 2021, February, March, and April. And the vaccination rates plummeted in April in the United States. People lost interest in the vaccines because safety reports came out. And the news of vaccine side effects, both non-fatal and fatal, started to come out and were reported. And America lost its enthusiasm for the vaccination. So nothing happened. There was almost no vaccination in the remainder of April, May, and June, and July. And then we saw inducements. To get a free hot dog, a free donut, to get one hospital in Texas, Houston Methodist, started paying $100. No one would do it. $500, they wouldn't do it. Then there started to be raffles. You could get $1 million in a raffle.
I saw that in California.
You could get a free college scholarship in America. No one would do it. And so then the mandates came in.
Yeah. We have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, Doc.
Yes.
He had mentioned this was a state in the United States where I, it was 4 or 5 miles from the other place, but I forgot.
Oh, Virginia. I think you mentioned Virginia. He was saying that he was in New York where they were having all these lockdowns and mandates and restrictions, and right over in Virginia, it was a totally different picture.
I was in the District of Columbia, and there were lockdowns and restrictions. We couldn't even get a cup of coffee in a Starbucks in the District of Columbia near the Washington Monument Lincoln Memorial. But then if we went over to Virginia, we stayed in Pentagon City, there were no restrictions whatsoever. We didn't wear masks, and we were able to go into... But the point I'm making is that is a very small region.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense to have one part of it with these very strict measures and another one with nothing.
All right, 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Now, you went to the Senate, you went to Congress. Why did they call on you, Dr. McCullough, to come and speak with them there? Because there are a lot of doctors out there, but why did they come to you, and what did you really present to them, and how do you think that changed things?
I started working on early treatment for COVID-19 to help people avoid hospitalization and death, and worked with protocols, and I worked carefully across the country. We had experts from Yale, UCLA, Emory. We had consultants in France, elsewhere. And when we came up with our first protocol in the development, I got a call from the White House. I was called by Peter Navarro. he was one of the persons involved with the commercial supply of hydroxychloroquine. And I started working with Peter Navarro, people in the White House. Before you know it, I was contacted by Ron Johnson. And Ron Johnson had already held one Senate hearing on whether or not we should use steroids in the hospital. And Pierre Corey was the lead witness in that Senate hearing in May of 2020. And Senator Johnson said, I wanted to hold a Senate hearings on early treatment, break the news to America that we can treat COVID-19 at home, avoid hospitalization and death. And I was honored to be the lead witness November 19th, 2020.
Awesome. Pretty awesome. Is that a caller, producer? I'm not sure. It's blinking, but I don't know. Are you on the air? Hello?
Hello, Doc.
Hello?
Good night.
We can hear you?
I can hear you.
Yeah, go ahead. Hello? Go ahead, caller.
Did the good doctor, your guest, say that he was in Washington and he went to Virginia and they didn't wear a mask?
Right. So in the District of Columbia, we had to wear masks, and in order to get a cup of coffee, you have to have a vaccine card. However, 5 miles away in Virginia, which is in the greater Washington area, no masks were needed in the hotel in the Ritz-Carlton, no vaccine card. We could go to restaurants and completely normal.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Everyone's kind of on that point. I don't know. Everyone wants to go to Virginia, I guess, you know. Is that another call, or is that just a blinking light? I have no idea. Okay, thank you.
Well, to pick up on the Senate testimony, mm-hmm. So I was the lead presenter, and I presented what's called sequence multi-drug therapy for COVID-19. It's now copyrighted, the McCullough Protocol. This was the same approach that former President Trump received early in 2020, and later on, many individuals received it, including podcaster Joe Rogan, all-star quarterback Aaron Rodgers, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas. The vaccine failed. He got sick with COVID. He got the McCullough Protocol. And this was enormously effective. It leverages everything we have, including monoclonal antibodies, the new oral drugs from Merck and Pfizer. The point is, we need about 4 to 6 drugs in combination in a high-risk senior. Remember, former President Trump was in his 70s, and he's obese. He could have actually gotten sick with COVID-19. Instead, he breezed through it using the McCullough Protocol.
So where do you think that we're going from here? You're talking about the side effects. I've talked on the show about myocarditis in young men, and there are a lot of other things. I think a lot of behemoths don't realize there's a lot more information out there from than before, including Pfizer documents were released. What kind of stuff are we seeing in that, and should we be concerned at all?
Let's stay on vaccines. So with vaccines, there's now 1,000 peer-reviewed publications in the preprint server system or in the National Library of Medicine on fatal and non-fatal vaccine injury syndromes. The U.S. data are as follows from the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. In the United States, shortly after receiving the vaccine, we've had 12,103 Americans die, typically within 2 to 7 days after the vaccine. Over 320,000 Americans hospitalized or urgent care visits. We've had 5,196 cases of myocarditis, and I can tell you the CDC confirms every single case. I know because I've reported a few cases. And sadly, we've had 13,359 Americans permanently disabled after the vaccines. These safety numbers are considered unacceptable. Pfizer and the FDA are being sued by lead attorney Aaron Seary to divulge everything they knew. We now know in the first tranche of data that Pfizer has turned over in the federal lawsuit to a public health and professional review committee, of which I'm the chairman of the committee, Pfizer knew about 1,223 deaths worldwide within 90 days of release of their vaccine. 50 deaths in general, products should be pulled off the market.
Wow, this is really, really intense. I don't know how that's going to go over, but we're not meaning to be controversial or anything, but these are facts and these are data and this is information that's coming out. How is that being seen in the U.S., and is there still a push for mandates over there?
Well, we have news shows all over where people are furious at Pfizer, furious at the FDA for not shutting down the Pfizer vaccine for a safety review. We are having strong calls to drop all vaccine mandates. We've had one official Defeat the Mandates rally on January 23rd in Washington, D.C. And now we have the second one in Los Angeles this weekend, July 9th and 10th in, April 9th and 10th in Los Angeles. Americans are asking right now for all the mandates to be dropped and for the vaccines to be pulled off the market for a thorough safety review, all of them, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. None of them at this point in time appear sufficiently safe nor effective to leave on the market.
You know, that's going to be big here because there's still a big push for vaccination in the country. But I think that we have to be able to have dialogue as medical doctors, as scientists, and be able to go back and look at the information, review it, and make a difference in what we're doing. If we're not doing that, then there's definitely a problem there and we're not following science. So even if there is some stuff that's going on, we should be looking at this information. We should be updating what we're doing in terms of any program that we are having where there are some type of side effects. And I think that's what the main point of it is that we have to constantly be looking at the science, looking at the data, looking at the information that's coming out. But there's a lot of it. Where can people really kind of find out what's really going on? Because I think there is a real lack of where do people trust, where do people look? Because we know that people who are guiding us have been saying that it's all good, it's all great.
You know, it is clear that our government agencies, certainly in the United States, the CDC, the FDA, the National Institutes of Health, did not fulfill their responsibilities for having monthly review. And today it was announced that our CDC is going to basically undergo an overhaul, administrative overhaul. And if I have any input into it, I'm going to say in the future, monthly reports. We need a monthly report on how to treat the illness, outpatient and inpatient. We need a monthly report on how the vaccines are doing, safety and efficacy. We need a monthly report on contagion control, masks, sanitizers, other things that are going on. We need basically information. Our CDC, NIH, and FDA have failed us. The medical schools have failed us. We talked about this today in the Bahamas. You know, the medical schools and hospitals have given no public symposiums. We're going to have one here in Nassau on Thursday at the Church of God, 7 o'clock at night. And that's going to be, probably the first major public symposium that the city has had. I've given over 24 public symposiums. Americans are coming out in the thousands. Most of them are saying, listen, Dr. McCullough, we just want to get the facts, and that's all I'm going to show them.
So we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello, good night, Dr. D.
Hello, good night.
Yeah, good night, Dr. Peter McCullough.
Good night.
This is Afanya, Dr. McCullough. I follow you on Facebook. I've been anyone with 600 peer-reviewed studies I'm willing to listen to, and so I appreciate someone like you over here in the Bahamas. And the thing is, everything you said is totally correct because, you know, I was a science student in college, but I'm an enthusiast now. And so the mainstream narratives were always, I was always deviant with that, especially on air, right? And so I'm proud of somebody like you being the Truth for Health Foundation chief medical officer, right? And so maybe if you need an operative here in the Bahamas, I'll willingly be glad to do that, to dispense the truth. Now, I just wanted to put in some little quick input here, Dr. McCullough, because I was always suspicious about, just intuitively, about the asymptomatic spread. They had people believing that they were actually breathing out the viruses. And so on the CDC website, they had where if you're asymptomatic, you're less likely to transmit the disease because you're asymptomatic. You're not sneezing, coughing, runny nose, et cetera. Those are transmission mechanisms that the virus used to spread itself that they have learned from the host, right? And then the thing is, I was always weary about the misinformation about antibodies waning. And so we know that antibodies wane naturally. And so as the viral loads decrease, so I was always vexed about that. And the fact that they didn't tell you that, all right, if antibodies wane, right, Dr. McCullough, why is it that they wouldn't test for the B memory cells and the T memory cells that trigger the antibodies production after the virus is present? Also, facts about the relative and absolute risk reductions. All of these things are misinformation that they're giving out to people. Of course, we know about the lack of reporting and CDC had to go to court to release documents on their data that they have collected throughout the pandemic. And we saw the inefficacy of the vaccines from the 18 to 49-year-old, especially from 5 to 11-year-old, as Dr. Moby Saeed displayed. So I was wondering, why is it that they don't test for B cells and T cells instead of just antibodies? And they were using that narrative in order to get people to be vaccinated. So it was upsetting for me. And so I see where you have 600 peer-reviewed studies, and in your on the Joe Rogan report, and also on the article that you wrote about the vaccine narratives is crumbling, I see where you said that the narrative about the outdoor transmission, et cetera, all of these false narratives can the citizens, I see, and I heard you mention about a lawsuit earlier. Can people come together and countersuit the government for pushing these narratives without the scientific discourse? Because it's really, the narratives are crumbling, but nobody's paying the price for it. Because last night, or this morning on Dwight Show, I heard Dr. Archer was on, but there's a lady named, there's a Dutch lady, I think, I can't remember the name, Von Reitz or something like that. And she has this article about Dr. Fauci, them doing this research on the pandemic strains on the 1918 pandemic flu. And so what happened is they knew that...
52. Pull it in, because Dr. McCullough, you just gave him...
Yeah, and what they discovered was that mask wearing predisposes people and make them more susceptible to pneumonia. Because I had a cousin in the hospital who died, but they said he didn't have COVID, but he died from pneumonia. So we know pneumonia is a secondary infection. So why is it that they wasn't acknowledging these deviants in the narrative instead of just falling mainstream doctors and feeding the people misinformation?
Thank you.
For cytotoxic effects of the vaccine.
Thank you, 52. Give Dr. McCullough a chance to say something.
In the United States, we have this sports talk radio, and these men listen to this all day long. And when the caller finally gets on, he spends half an hour talking about his team and what's wrong with his team. It's kind of venting. But no, I really appreciate all those comments. Listen, I know you're not a doctor, but you really sound like one. And you made some fantastic points. All of them were on point. The antibodies, which are available now, if they're positive, they confer immunity. If they're not, it doesn't mean that someone's not immune. It's just that they do reduce. They reduce 40% per month over time, as shown in a paper by first author Israel. Now, the T cells have memory that lasts for years. With SARS-CoV-1, the T cell response has been around for at least two decades. Spanish flu, you implied, has been around for many, many decades. The T cell response, there is a test you can measure. It's called T-Detect. You can go online and go to tdetect.com. You can sign up for it. The lab director approves it. And then if you have a LabCorp here in the Bahamas, you can go to a LabCorp office and get your blood test measured. And you can look at your T cell response to COVID-19. It basically assesses for minor chromosomal rearrangements on the surface of T cells that confers immunity. Both the antibodies and the T cell are FDA emergency use authorized to assess immunity. And some of the antibody tests now are fully FDA approved. Some of our in vitro diagnostics are very good. You're right about the government being sued. The United States government, by the way, is being sued in dozens and dozens and dozens of cases, particularly the military, because of what's called malfeasance. That's wrongdoing by those in position of authority. But great comments.
Okay. Turn it back up for me again. Caller, we have another caller. Okay, I'm sorry about that, caller. If you can call back, I'm just checking the time. We have a few more minutes. There was somebody texting, but because the phone was off, I couldn't really get to your test. So let me see if I can pull it up right now. And so it said, Dr. D. Archer, can you post a Zoom link for Thursday evening? I will not be available in person, but would really want to Zoom meeting. Okay, yes, I'll. Well, I'm doing it on Facebook Live, so I won't have a Zoom this time because I'm not there. And then it says, listening into your show with Dr. McCullough, my husband was hospitalized locally last August with COVID pneumonia, hypertension, diabetes, now still having episodes of shortness of breath on movement at time. Oxygen saturation is fine, 96% on room air. Also was treated as POTS status, post-COVID. We are very interested in, we are very interested in how to treat long COVID for the best quality of life. I think we have a caller, and then I'll let you answer that, Dr. McCullough. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Yes, caller.
Good evening.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Turn your
Okay, great. Yeah, well, I have a question for Dr. McCullough. It's really about vaccinating children, because one of the things that I was really concerned about was this push to vaccinate our young people. And when I was looking at the data, I couldn't see there was any risk for, there was no emergency regarding children. And yet there was this incredible push to try and get kids vaccinated. And I just wondered what your view was, because I didn't want my daughter to be vaccinated with an experimental product that had been rushed through, for which there was no long-term data. And then we found out that the vaccines weren't effective at all against the Omicron Beta. And there was, you know, other things that we found out. So I wonder what his view is on the children's situation, because there was quite a bit of pressure, peer pressure, for children to get vaccinated.
Okay, just before, 3236232, 3254316, 3254259. That was a request from a doctor, actually.
You know, I've been on national TV saying that really no children should be vaccinated. And, you know, Governor Ron DeSantis and Surgeon General Joe Ledeppel of Florida agree. You know, Florida is not supporting any childhood vaccination. Now, if there's a special case, a child with cystic fibrosis or some other condition, and the parents, you know, with their doctor decide to do it, that's their choice. But the entire state of Florida, which is a very populous state, is not supporting childhood vaccination. Why? Because the majority of the children have already had COVID. If they get it, it's a very mild illness. It's not threatening to them. It's easily treated, by the way, with some nebulizers and oral medicines if we need to. And the vaccines don't have a sufficient safety profile. In a paper by House and colleagues, by the CDC MMWR publication, in the December 31st issue, they published the childhood data. And in the tables, my interpretation as a doctor and epidemiologist, it's not safe for children.
Yep. And so the question about long COVID, any suggestions? Because we do have quite a few people who are suffering from long COVID.
That case that was described actually fits the typical case, a severe case of COVID. Typically, long COVID occurs after severe COVID, which is prolonged. The spike protein on the virus does damage the brain, the nerves in the body. What she's describing is POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. The spike protein actually damages the adrenal glands and the sympathetic chain of nerves that basically reset the heart rate. People will notice the heart rate is 10 or 20 points higher. The blood pressure may be higher or lower, and this takes many months to work out. A lot of times patients see cardiologists, internists, or family doctors, and they do need some temporary medicine support to get through long COVID.
Okay. So temporary support, where would they look? Is that with the cardiologist, the pulmonologist? So that sounds like a multidisciplinary team.
It depends on the syndrome. Clearly, the thrombotic syndromes can be scary. So, for instance, mm-hmm. there are thrombotic syndromes in the brain. There's stroke, obviously CT scanning, blood thinners, all types of approaches to manage thrombotic stroke. The neurologic syndromes, I found actually the use of fluvoxamine. Fluvoxamine is what's called a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It's been proven in 3 randomized trials of COVID, and it actually may have some effect on the residual virus in the body in long COVID. There are no published randomized trials, but I believe it plays a role. For the pleural pericardial syndromes, I end up using colchicine and prednisone. Some doctors, there's a protocol from Dr. Santini in Yale that features prolonged ivermectin in the long COVID syndrome. It's clear that patients need extra, in my view, nutraceutical support with vitamins and nutraceuticals. They need lots of fresh air, exercise, and cardiopulmonary and physical rehabilitation.
Yeah, I do a physiotherapy kind of regime with a lot of my patients who are suffering from long COVID. But producer, can we take this last call? We did get in a little late, so we're going to take this last call, and then we're pretty much done.
Okay. Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, first I would like to say thank you, Optimus Bahamas. Thank you so much for making this happen. So, big hug to you. And thank you, Peter McCullen. I've been following you for the last, seems a couple years or even a half, and I'm so happy that you're here and speaking. The question that I have is, why do you think that the medical institutions, when treatments were available for COVID-19, why do you think that they were not made to the public to be made aware of? And so that's probably one of the questions. And if I just quickly say, versus going into the hospital and all that. And the other, would you agree that the COVID-19 was really a plandemic for big pharma and big corporations with the support of and backing of the media, who partner with all of this to control the people, and as well as for major profits and the billions that they have made, and they are still pushing? Thank you.
You know, I was asked that very question over the last year, about a year ago, by Tucker Carlson. I went on the long program with Tucker Carlson today, but I was also asked recently in December by podcaster Joe Rogan. I think it's clear. I think there was an intentional suppression of early treatment that resulted in fear, suffering, hospitalization, and death, and effectively prepared the population for mass vaccination. I think the favoritism for vaccination is related to the suppression of treatment, because the societies, the hospitals, the doctors, and the governments that suppressed early treatment or didn't offer treatment are the same ones that are mass promoting the vaccine. They're the same. And in the United States, we have medical organizations that have taken that stance. So in a sense, the medical organizations against early treatment, but mass promoting the vaccines. In terms of the planned nature of the pandemic, I'm not an expert on that, but I will tell you, there are very good works of nonfiction out there. The best is by Peter and Ginger Bragan. It's called COVID-19 and the Global Predators. We Are the Prey. I think it's about $3 on Kindle. The hard copy is about $10. And this has 1,000 references, nonfiction. So if you want to see the patents between Moderna and the Chinese planning the vaccine before the virus ever came out of the lab, if you want to see the communications between the U.S. National Institutes of Health, the EcoHealth Alliance, Ralph Baric, the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, Gavi, CEPI, the Chinese Communist Party, it's all there. It's all in the open. There's no hidden documents here. They're all connected. And there are predators. There are clearly global predators right now that are capitalized on it. When Klaus Schwab wrote the book, The Great Reset, and saying COVID-19 is the opportunity to reset the world economy, he meant it. When President Biden just said recently that COVID-19 is the opportunity for a new world order, I think we should listen to it. They mean it.
They mean what they say. Well, you know, we've cut down the show. It's an hour, so we are done. And if you want to hear more, Dr. Peter McCullough, presented to you by Optimus. We're going to be at the Joe Farrington Road, the Church of God. He's going to be putting up his slides, so you can see this information for yourself. And if you have more questions, you can put them out there. So we'll see you Thursday night, Joe Farrington Road, the Church of God. Good night.